Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 5th, 2026, and the time is 8:02 a.m. Happy to see everyone in the room today. Okay. Members present are Representative Kai Holland, Representative Carolyn Hall, Representative Steve St. Clair, Representative G. Nelson, Co-Chair Donna Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Rebecca Himshute. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members and staff to please silence your cell phones. And before we get started, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, who's our recording secretary, and from the Juno LIO, Renzo Moises is with us this morning. We have four items on the agenda today. We'll start with HB 329, Electric Utility Certificate of Fitness. Then we'll move to HB 282, Automated Traffic Safety Cameras. Then we'll go to HB 155, Alcohol Sales Local Option. And then we'll hear for the first time HB 220, Easements and Rights of Way in State Parks. I think that's if we have time, but we should have time. For HB 329, we'd like to, it's an act relating to certificates of fitness for employees of an electric utility, and it is a House Community and Regional Affairs Committee bill. It's the second hearing of HB 329. We did not receive any amendments by the deadline. Do any committee members have any questions or comments before we take action on the bill? And we do have folks online for questions. Okay, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm not sure exactly who's on the line, but I'm curious, maybe this is for the bill sponsor, but what is the urgency behind this bill? The word urgent has been used a couple of times, and I'm curious to know more about that context.
We do have Bill Stamm on the line with the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or we can go to Co-Chair Mears. Co-Chair Mears, do you want to?
I think Mr. Stamm would be great.
Mr. Stamm, if you're able to unmute yourself and put yourself on record and help us understand the urgency of this bill.
Yes, good morning. Bill Stamm with Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Thank you, Representative Himshute, and through the chair, Representative Hall. The urgency for AVEC is that we supply power to 58 rural communities that are spread all over Alaska, and by adhering to the interpretation of the law as it stands now, we are required to move and mobilize the few certificated linemen that we have all over the state at a moment's notice for any items that need to be repaired in our distribution systems. AVEC has operated under this exemption in communities less than 2,500 since its inception in 1969 and has found since August that we are getting further and further behind in the work that we need to do in these small communities. We are experiencing additional costs for hiring contractors and extensive travel. When we move folks from one town to another, it's not just the plane tickets to get them from a city to a hub and from a hub to a smaller community. We also have to transport hundreds of pounds of gear. We're finding that the small plane carriers that move our freight and our people are increasing their restrictions on weight loads, so often our personnel have to travel on separate planes from their freight. Coordinating the logistics is cumbersome, and all those things happen every day. But with this new interpretation, it happens at an unreasonable amount, and we are quite truly getting behind in maintaining the systems that we operate.
I'd like to mention that Representative Prox joined us at 8:04, and I think I'll just add it's when Bethel came into the AVEC network that caused this change. And so by adding in Bethel, the interpretation of the regulations around this led to how AVEC is having to operate right now and caused some problems. Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you to the chair. The Bethel addition was quite some time ago. It's the reinterpretation from just a few months ago that has changed this way in which AVEC has had to do business. So these new costs and these new delays in service are relatively new from the way they've been doing business. And Mr. Stamm and other offices, frankly, were trying to work through other problems or through other avenues to fix the problem. And it was concluded that a statutory fix was the way this needed to happen. So if we don't move this through this session, then there's a whole year of service delays and expenses.
Okay, Representative St. Clair. Oh, did you have any more follow-up on that? Okay, Representative St. Clair.
Through the chair, why do we know why the interpretation changed? If Bethel's been in the group for a while, what changed?
Mr. Stamm, could you speak to that, please?
I don't know if it's appropriately characterized as a change in interpretation. I think it's something that came to their awareness. It's the way you read the legislation. I guess the wording of the legislation applies specifically to a utility and not specifically to the communities, and that's what we're attempting to correct in this amendment to the bill, or amendment to the legislation. The fact that these communities are small, remote, difficult to access is not changed by the fact that AVEC acquired a utility and joined to its service area a location that has a population greater than 2,500. The population in Bethel is about 6,000. One of the avenues that we pursued was that the definition of service area might be construed to be an isolated, restricted area, but I think the way it's being interpreted, service area, is all of the locations that a utility serves. So AVEC has a certificate of public convenience and necessity from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to serve and be the utility in 58 communities, only one of which is over the population of 2,500.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay, seeing no other questions, I'll turn to Representative Hall for a motion.
I move HB 329 Work Order 34-LS1412/I from committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Are there objections? Seeing no objection, HB 329 Work Order 34-LS1412/I moves from committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations. And I guess we'll take an at ease and do the paperwork right now. We'll do that quickly. So at ease. We're back on record. We're going to take up the next item on our agenda, House Bill 282, an act relating to municipal regulation of automated traffic safety cameras. This is the second hearing of the bill. We're going to hear from a couple of other invited testifiers and then open public testimony. So I think Representative Fields and is it Michael Noddy? Would you guys come forward, put your names on the record, and provide a brief recap of the bill?
Zach Fields, House District 17. This bill would allow localities to use automatic traffic safety cameras, and committee members that express interest in hearing from police and local government officials. So hopefully Police Chief Sean Case is online. And I believe we do not have.
No, not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
Tom Atkinson, Carrie Harris, Pam Golden, and Zach Hartman online right now.
Okay, so Zach Hartman is a traffic engineer with the municipality, so if there are questions about reducing fatalities, Pam Golden, of course, is with DOT. I'm guessing Mr. Atkinson is online for public testimony.
Yeah, I see. I recognize now that they're down for testimony.
See if we can get the police chief and assembly member online as well.
Yeah, okay. Do you want us to move forward in the agenda while you do that and come back to this bill, or should we?
Do you just want to open? Why don't you do public testimony, and I'll text the chief and assembly member.
Yeah, that sounds good. So we'll skip ahead to public testimony, and then we'll come back to the invited comments in a little bit. So With that in mind, I see we have two testifiers online, and so I'm going to open public testimony. And if you could, I think we'll go to Tom Atkinson. If you could put your name on the record, Mr. Atkinson, and provide your testimony.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. This is Alex Atkinson. I live in Spinard, and I'm concerned about traffic safety in Anchorage. I think we have an epidemic of red light running. I did submit written testimony that I hope you'll read. It's brief. This bill wouldn't... we don't have enough police in Anchorage for writing tickets for traffic violations. So we need to rely, in my opinion, on technology, which would include cameras and the associated computers that could issue tickets that were done in other jurisdictions nationwide. But currently, no local municipality can seize that option of using the cameras. Current state law requires a police officer to write the ticket. So your passage enactment of this bill is a first step towards allowing local municipalities to use cameras if they so wish. So I did, that's it. I'd ask you to please pass the bill out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have another testifier online, Carrie Harris, if you'd like to unmute yourself and provide your testimony, please. So, Carrie Harris, we're not hearing you. If you're online, please unmute. We show you as unmuted on this side. Okay, it looks like maybe Carrie Harris is not with us right now, or there's a technology problem. So I'm going to look to see if there's anyone in the room to testify. I don't see anyone in the room. And I'm going to take a quick at ease and see if we can figure out the technology. At ease. Okay, we're back on the record. And since we weren't able to get Ms. Harris, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony and remind folks that they can always send their written testimony to HCRA, that stands for House Community and Regional Affairs, so HCRA@akleg.gov. And with that said, Representative Fields, I don't have anybody else showing up here.
Is Zach Hartman not still online?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we still have Pam Golden, who is the state traffic and safety engineer with DOT in Fairbanks, and we have Zach Hartman in Anchorage, who is the traffic signals manager, traffic engineering department, municipality of Anchorage. So we do have some folks online, just not...
Yeah, sorry, all of them. Yeah,
not everybody we were expecting. So are there questions from the committee about the bill or for these folks that we have online? Representative St. Clair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative Fields, so the Anchorage Assembly refuses to change. Let me back up a little bit. This falls under the purview of the Anchorage Assembly, yet they don't want to lift the ban. Is that correct?
Through the chair, no, because in the charter it would take a initiative passed on the ballot. The assembly would not have the ability to change it.
And has this been tried before? I'm sorry, follow up.
No, to my knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Holland?
Great, thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I wonder if you could clarify, at least for me, the comment we heard in the public testimony moment made a reference to the ability to write tickets being limited to a police officer. As I understand the bill, it's really not changing any of that, any of those requirements if they exist. This, I think, is just allowing the use of the cameras. It's not saying what the cameras will be used for, or is it? I don't believe it's actually authorizing the camera to write a ticket or anything, but I wonder if you could clarify what we heard and this issue of whether or not you have to be a live officer to write the ticket and if this is making any changes to that.
Through the chair, I think Mr. Atkinson's point is that in-person enforcement alone is insufficient in the context of extreme police understaffing. I believe it would be possible under the bill if the assembly wanted to, if this bill passed, then the assembly could take public input and develop a process to have automatic red light enforcement, whether that would be cameras alone versus cameras augmenting an officer's presence, kind of like we talked about last time where you actually can't do enforcement without a camera. That would be, I believe, a local decision.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, it seems to me that the actual language of this from the perspective of the legislature is, well, it is literally a municipality may not ban the use of automated safety cameras. So today, if they wanted to change, if the citizens of Anchorage wanted to change the charter, they certainly could do that. And I appreciate the concern, the difficulty of doing that, but they could. And this is very similar, I think, to the bill we just heard. We're trying to do something at the statewide level that we're thinking about in large cities, in the same way that somebody was thinking about certificates of fitness applies to large municipalities, and then something came up, changed it later. And so sometime down the road, if this bill were to pass, sometime down the road we could authorize DOT to set up safety cameras wherever they felt like. And the municipalities, some may not want to do that. It doesn't apply to North Pole because there are no... No, that's not true. There are traffic lights now. God, I got to move. At some point. Anyway, this is a local decision. Regardless of the merits and the need for traffic safety cameras, this seems to be a local decision, can be done, and we need to really be careful about the unintended consequences of this.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Hall?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Fields, I'm looking at the supporting document here dated March 4th that has a list of the Anchorage and Anchorage Police and Fairbanks Police Department reports. Any idea why there's been such a significant change on the Fairbanks reports between 2015 and 2025 with all three columns, failure to lead, ran a stoplight, ran a red light? It looks like there's been significant improvement over the 10 years with Fairbanks's reports. I'm just curious if you guys could talk a little bit more about that.
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect it's actually understaffing as well. So the number of citations being issued does not actually correspond to the number of violations. When you look at Anchorage, ran a stop sign dropping by from 153 violations to 2017 to 58 in 2024, anyone who lives in Anchorage knows the number of violations did not drop. The ability to police it dropped. I know that other jurisdictions, Fairbanks, Kodiak, have suffered as extreme of police understaffing as Anchorage to the point that some communities have had literally no police on the beat during certain times of day, which is pretty wild to contemplate. So I think it's, yeah, the number of citations does not necessarily correspond to the number of violations when you don't have nearly enough staff.
Follow up? Precisely. Thank you for that. And I think it speaks to a broader, larger issue when it comes to policing in our communities, and every community is different. Like, for example, you bring up, you know, some communities not having a police officer on shift. My understanding is that a few years ago, Kodiak was in a situation similar to that, where there was no housing for them to hire a police officer from outside. And so policing in these communities on every level, whether it's violent crime or, you know, running a red light, our communities are suffering in a variety of ways as a result. Thank you.
Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fields, how many other municipalities would this impact?
Through the chair, Anchorage is the only one I'm aware of that it would impact.
Okay, and follow up? More of a statement than a question per se, and I think we spoke about this before. The majority of the camera systems that are done are usually outsourced. I've seen it in many places. They give the DPS gives the authority for so-and-so or company, whatever, to write tickets, etc. Based on this, would that preclude that?
Through the chair, it's not designed to preclude it. It's designed to give the locality the option of how they implement it.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mainly just a comment, kind of in response to the question that Rep. St. Clair asked, is that it would affect all municipalities. It would affect Anchorage directly, but it would affect all municipalities by saying that they can't do that. The thing that Anchorage did, the thing that the voters did at one point that there's challenges to undo now, would say that nobody can do that. And I think that's the main point, right, is that there's local challenges to rolling this back. There's a desire to do it, but it's going to be hard. Is that clear? Is that question clear?
Yeah, through the chair, there's there's not really an interest group that represents safety of citizens in our city of 300,000 people. So just as a practical reality, I don't know who would carry through running the public information campaign to change the municipal charter on this. And that it is a practical issue, and I totally understand where Representative Prox is coming from. This immediately fixes an Anchorage problem, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, it's a life and death issue. We have people getting killed approximately every 2 weeks. And I don't know what citizens have the capacity to run a municipal charter change. We have the ability. All that this bill would do is put it back in the hands of the Assembly and let the Assembly make a decision. That's all it does. It does not force any municipality to do anything. It restores the option of local government and police, and that's all I'm trying to do. And, you know, we don't have to pass the bill. We can wait for some interest group to arise representing the public safety of all 300,000 people who live in Anchorage. But, man, a lot of people are going to die in the meantime if that's our approach.
Okay, before we go to Representative Prox, I just wanted to, on your previous comments, Representative Prox, you said you were drawing a parallel between this bill and the previous bill, and I think what you were trying to say is, I want to make sure I understood you correctly, mm-hmm. that the previous bill was sort of possibly an urban interpretation of what's needed in all other places, and that's how you were connecting the two bills, because the other bill, I don't think is directly connected in any way, but your point was that we're trying to make a rule that fits everybody, and it doesn't always fit everybody.
Yep.
Okay. And then you had another comment or question?
I did. I guess I haven't looked at it from the other perspective. We, the legislature, could, if maybe existing law, in fact, allows DOT or I guess it would be DOT to install safety cameras if they thought that was a good idea. And if you're doing a big project, you might as well do safety cameras because it wouldn't cost a whole lot more to do it. So I think there's somebody from DOT online. I wonder if we could get their perspective on safety cameras and especially their authority to install them if they think if DOT thinks it's a good idea.
So our DOT person online is Pam Golden. She's the state traffic and safety engineer. Could you unmute yourself, please, and let us know if you need the question again?
Sure thing. Yeah, this is Pam Golden. I'm up in Fairbanks. But right now, with the exception of Anchorage, safety cameras, we believe, are allowed anywhere because they're not precluded from being out there. DOT is not an enforcement agency. So if, you know, we were to go out and install these safety cameras, it would be in partnership with a law enforcement agency, you know, to suit whatever it is they need from them. So, you know, we could possibly provide funding to install safety cameras because they are a proven safety countermeasure, but we're not in the enforcement business. So it wouldn't be us just going out and putting them up.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I'm sorry, I didn't write your name down.
Pam Golden.
Pam Golden, Ms. Golden. DOT did a lot of work recently at the what they call the GARS intersection in Fairbanks, and that was to redesign the whole intersection in order to reduce accidents, and the serious accidents are somebody turning left against a traffic light, either not stopping or jumping or I don't know what, doesn't get into that deal, but if DOT thought that installing safety cameras, which I think from just a public safety perspective would be a good idea, but they cause other problems. But anyway, if DOT thought that was a good idea, could they just install those unless the city of Fairbanks objected to it?
Ms. Golden?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. Unless somebody is actually taking a look at the cameras, they're not effective unless there's a law enforcement piece tied to that. We wouldn't do it at GARS without, you know, the city of Fairbanks actually, police department actually wanting them and being willing to use them. So it's sort of a, you know, we're here saying, yes, they do reduce crashes if they're put in an enforcement. Is part of that piece of, you know, why they're installed. But just putting them up to have them without that law enforcement piece is not something DOT would do.
Follow-up?
Right.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up. So DOT... would, as a matter of good practice, as you do, they would notify the, FMATS and the city of Fairbanks and everybody else for the public process. And there would be a possibility of objecting to that. And if the city or somebody objected to that, you wouldn't do that. But now with this law, the way I read it literally is you could do that whether the people wanted to or not. They don't have the final say. Is that a fair statement?
Ms. Golden?
Through the chair, Prox, again, we're not in enforcement, so
yep. Okay.
Putting them up with no one using them is just a camera on the, you know, the pole. We wouldn't go out and put them up unless we were asked to put them up. So it could come up in project scoping. Maybe the Fairbanks Police wants to try it. You know, we do reach out to all of our partners locally, but it isn't something necessarily we just go out and do. Every intersection, you know, is a little different. Yes, GARS is unique. And so each intersection might need a different countermeasure. And I'll point out this is not just what we're talking about here, the red light running cameras, but also could be speed cameras. And I think Bill also discusses them at railroad crossings.
Right.
Before we go to Rep. Holland, I'm going to ask Ms. Golden to just walk us through the shared responsibility. So, for example, my hometown of Sitka, we have a state road. I don't think we could call it a highway. But we have a state road right through the heart of town, and we've had this increase in cruise tourism, and we have a lot of safety questions, and the state is, this is going to sound like a judgment, I don't mean it that way, slow to respond because it's the state to what we perceive as an urgent need in Sitka, and we have limited scope to do what we think needs to be done, but the state is actually better equipped to actually evaluate the situation and give us solutions. So there's this back and forth and a truly shared responsibility for this thoroughfare through my town. So how does it work for you as an organization to identify, so for example, we as the community of Sitka have gone to the state and said, how do we make this more safe with this change in use? And then there's a back and forth and you're helping us. If cameras were a solution in Sitka, what would that look like? You would come back with an analysis saying what you guys need are these cameras, but then you also need the personnel to monitor the cameras. That's not a state responsibility, but can you help me understand the process of arriving at a safe solution and who has which responsibility?
To the chair, thank you. It's you know, the regional folks are out there doing what they do. I will be completely upfront. We have not talked about cameras because of we know it's a politically sensitive issue to talk about cameras. They come with a lot of controversy, so it is not something, at least in the recent past, that we've proposed for locations. Generally, because cameras are almost always tied to enforcement, we're looking to the enforcement side of the safe system approach to say, we really need these here. Similarly, talking about a project in Anchorage, we are putting red light indicator lights up. That is, if an officer happens to be nearby, they can see that the light has turned red and not have to have that confirmation of another officer seeing that. So there are other tools that we have sort of, not sort of, but there are other tools we can do that provide that support to law enforcement that are, you know, stop shy of and some sort of automated enforcement. But, you know, if the city of Sitka said, we want to start doing automated enforcement, that's definitely something we'd say, yeah, we can support that and we can use funding to install those cameras. But then, you know, it's handed over to law enforcement at that point.
Okay, let's go to Rep. Holland. You had an additional thought?
Yeah, thank you. I think through the chair to the bill sponsor. I won't belabor the connections that I'm making between the comments and this discussion, but it has led me to a question that I'd like to pose, and that is that as we look at this bill, which I think in essence is reversing or negating the will of voters that passed a charter amendment that took away the ability to use cameras, I'm left sitting here struggling with the question of when does the legislature step in and negate the decision that voters made. And I get it that undoing the decision the voters made is very difficult, and we have this legislative process that allows us to just kind of zoom around, do an end run on this thing, and make the will of the voters go away. Fundamentally, I accept that we're not really turning on cameras by doing this. We're simply reestablishing the control of the assembly to make some decisions. But what we are fundamentally doing here is saying that we as a legislature are going to undo something the voters decided. And when should we do that? I think the way I'd like to frame this question beyond kind of the bigger picture is, do we have a request from the city municipal assembly asking us to do this that would reflect some will of the representatives of Anchorage saying, do this for us? Or are we doing this for them? In which case, I'm troubled about our role in undoing something that the voters said they wanted done. And I'm struggling with when we should do that versus when we should say, well, it may be hard for the voters to do, but they did it, they should undo it. When do we step in and do this? And I would feel better if I knew that the Assembly or somebody in Anchorage said, do this for us, please.
And in, before you respond to that, I had a similar kind of question, so I'm just going to add to it. We have an Assembly process to put a ballot measure on the ballot, so it doesn't have to be a citizen's initiative to put a question on the ballot. The Assembly can put a question on the ballot. So has this question been on the local ballot? So two questions.
Through the chair, no. I think our local government officials are also nervous about changing something voters put in place 25 years ago. For me, it's a test of both time and circumstances. If a lot of time has transpired but circumstances have not changed, I wouldn't be putting forward a bill. If a little bit of time had elapsed, I wouldn't put forward a bill even if circumstances had changed. If voters had passed this 2 years ago or even 5 years ago, I wouldn't put it forward. But in this case, it was over a quarter century, and the circumstances are wildly different. So, you know, we have the same question on ballot initiatives passed statewide, and I think there's a very high bar if you're changing something that passed, certainly within a single election cycle, within a year or two, really high bar to change it. 4 years, I still think there's a high bar. 15 years, if circumstances change, I think it's valid to look at altering it. But yeah, everyone can assess it for themselves. That's just kind of how I look at it. I know that some Assembly members do want to change it. That's why Erin Day was calling in to express her support as an individual Assembly member. I don't know. Obviously, they have busy schedules, and the police chief, same thing. But yeah, I think one of the positive things that's come out of this bill is actually forcing a little bit more of a discussion about it in the municipality. And to your question, Chair Hemshue, the Assembly can put a question on the ballot. I think there's been much more focus on safety just within the last 2 years in the municipality of Anchorage. Much needed, and that's very positive. There's a lot we need to do. My point about there's no interest group that represents safety is, you know, when you go to vote on a ballot initiative, there's a really significant public education effort in a city of 300,000 people. And there is just not a group to go out there and educate people on the intricacies of traffic safety. It is really in the weeds, as you've heard in this discussion from just in our fairly brief exchanges with Pam Golden. So that's the practical reality I see is the average person, you know, if someone gets hit at 25 miles per hour, pedestrian gets hit by a car at 25 miles per hour, odds are they are not going to die. If they get hit at 45 miles per hour, they are almost certainly going to die. So all these roads where we're seeing people die and there's a correlation between speed and red light running, the reality is we reduce the speed, we have compliance with the law, we're going to cut the death rate probably in half. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how do you educate 300,000 people about that for a ballot initiative when I think the current municipal ballot has at least 9 citywide items? I mean, it is a real practical challenge. And since human life is on the line, I'm really comfortable putting this back in the hands of the Assembly. Let them go through an ordinance. Let them take public comment and see if they want to do it.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This question is for both of the folks who are online, Ms. Golden and Mr. Hartman. I'm wondering if both of you could please outline from your particular jurisdictions the safety measures that each of your agencies have gone through when it comes to certain Anchorage intersections to make them safer. And I'm most curious about the Minnesota Northern Lights Benson Boulevard interchange, and on that particular interchange or intersection, I'm particularly interested in hearing from Mr. Hartman, but it, really the question is for both individuals. What are the safety features that have already been undertaken and examined when it comes to making these roads safer for pedestrians?
Let's start with Ms. Golden, and then we'll go to Mr. Hartman after that. Ms. Golden, can you let us know if you need the question again?
For the record, Pam Golden, DOT, through the chair, Representative Hall. So there's a lot going on at Minnesota Benson Northern Lights. As everyone is aware, there is the pedestrian safety barrier fencing that was installed, I want to say late 2024. We have looked. There have been no crashes in the area where that fence was installed. There are crashes still up at the intersections. There are a couple of projects in design right now, one on Northern Lights and one on Benson, that will add that fourth crosswalk that is quote missing. Right now, if you want to cross as a pedestrian, you only can cross on three legs. There's a Northern Lights pavement preservation project, an HSIP highway safety improvement program project that will add that fourth crosswalk, and there's a Minnesota sidewalk project, I think, is the name of it, that adds that fourth crosswalk at Benson. So I'll let Zach speak to, signal timings and things that can be done with that. But we do have things in the works at those locations.
Thank you, Ms. Golden. Mr. Hartman, can you unmute yourself and let us know if you need the question again?
This is Zach Hartman with the Traffic Engineering Department in the Municipality of Anchorage. Yeah, on top of some of the countermeasures and projects that Pam mentioned, our team has done some tweaks to signal timing at that specific intersection, Minnesota Northern Lights, and other intersections in Anchorage, modifying how we time for pedestrian crossings. At Minnesota Northern Lights, the recent fatalities have happened at night at higher speeds, so we've changed how we have the signal timed at late night, so it's not just, resting in green along Minnesota trying to slow people down. There's also some systematic things happening at signals in Anchorage in tight coordination with Pam and her staff, so simple things like adding retro-reflective tape around the outside of signals, making them more noticeable in hopes that, maybe a distracted or inattentive driver sees that red light asking them to stop, as well as adding a single signal head per lane. Sometimes now it'll be, one signal head for every two lanes. So physically more lights shining in the eyes of drivers. And those last couple things I mentioned are also Federal Highway's proven safety countermeasures. So we are implementing these other Federal Highway proven safety countermeasures in Anchorage at these intersections to try and improve safety, utilizing any tool in the toolbox that we have.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Hartman, I'm going to focus this question towards you since your boots on the ground in Anchorage and Ms. Golden is in Fairbanks, but is what has been done thus far enough?
That was to Mr. Hartman.
Mr. Hartman.
Yeah, through the chair, I think the measure of if it's enough or not, I think the only true answer is what's reflected in the safety data. And if people are still getting hurt and injured on our roadways in Anchorage, then it's clearly not enough.
Thank you, Madam Kucher. Thank you, Mr. Hartman. Okay.
And I just had one or two more questions for the sponsor. So when you said this bill impacts Anchorage, my question is, are there other municipalities, to your knowledge, that ban these cameras? Considering in most of my district, like I said, we have two cameras in my entire district, so I don't think we have any bans. But do you know of any other municipalities with bans?
Not that I'm aware of at this time. Thank you. Zach Fields, for the record.
Okay. And does the state have any ban anywhere that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. I find myself struggling with, this is an Anchorage issue, let Anchorage solve it, and yet every single one of those fatalities, to my knowledge, is an Alaskan. And so this is a really sticky question that you've brought to us. So if there are no other questions, I think we're going to set the bill aside for now and revisit it another time. So. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Prox, did you have a question?
No, that's what we should do. I have a proposed amendment.
Okay, yeah.
Can I mention one more thing, actually?
Sure.
Through the chair, so in the Senate CR&A committee did advance the bill. They did an amendment. No municipality over 25,000 population may impose a ban, so that's what they chose to do. If members have other amendment ideas, I'm happy to work with them, and just wanted to bring you up to date on what's going on in the other body. Thank you.
Okay, so with that said, I think we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for now and give it some more consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next on the agenda is House Bill 155, an act relating to alcohol. relating to local option elections, relating to the statewide database of alcohol purchases, relating to alcohol licenses, endorsements, and permits, relating to municipal regulation and taxation of alcoholic beverages, and providing for an effective date and holding the longest title to date list championship in this committee. I would like to invite Representative Foster. I think he's tied up right now, so we have Paul LeBoule to come forward. And we had requested more information, and you created an entire presentation for us. So if you could put your name on the record and share your presentation. And just for the committee's awareness on this bill, we do have Kevin Richard, who's the director of the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office, online for questions. So, Mr. LeBoule, good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul LeBoule, staff to Representative Foster. Yeah, at the last committee hearing, there was interest in having a broader understanding of the underlying local option bills that we're amending slash adding to. And so this presentation goes over that. So local options are in Title IV, and they govern allowing municipalities and unincorporated communities the option to restrict sale, transportation, and possession of alcohol in various different ways. And if a community does not exercise a local option, then the rest of Title IV applies. The local option was first done in 1937, and basically it allowed them to hold elections on the sale of liquor in general. So it was broad local option, not very detailed, but municipalities had an opt-out provision, and unincorporated communities had an opt-in provision. In 1976, that got altered and required municipal election for a new license to be issued. And then 1980 is when we had a broader scope of things, which put things largely the way they are today. And then 86 is when they said that you could ban possession. And so what are the local options? Well, local option one bans sale but allows importation and possession. It's what's colloquially known as DAMP. Option two allows the community to pick which license type they will allow. So there are multiple license types, and so on the ballot it would say which license type they're allowing. Option three is the municipal option, which we'll get more into that one later on in the presentation. Option four bans sale and importation. And then option five was the one added in 1986 that adds the ability to ban possession. How is local option exercised? It's done by election. The city decides. It's largely like the state ballot initiative process. Anybody can do a petition. You have to get a number of signatures. In this case, it's 35% of the people who voted in the last election have to sign off, and then the municipal clerk signs off on it. They put it on the ballot and goes to a vote of the people. How many communities use a local option? Well, 23 ban sale, 6 ban specific license types, 9 municipal options are exercised, 41 ban sale and importation, and 30 are dry. They ban sale, importation, and possession.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Do you know when the last local option election was held? When was the last time a community took this up? It seems like it's been this way for a really long time.
I don't have – oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have the exact number, but I do know from researching it that after the 1986 ad, so there was a rush in the 80s in general. Once 1980 passed, a bunch of local options were exercised, and then That's when they found that there was a problem with enforcement and things weren't really working out. And so in 86, they did the ban of possession, and then there was another rush. And since the 80s, like once the local options were put in, the elections have become very rare.
Communities have kind of settled and said, here's where we are.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now we're into the local option that we're trying to address, which is option three, the municipal option. Right now, if you decide that the only license that can be operated is by a municipality, that means all license types have to be operated by that municipality. Now, they can run a package store and not run a restaurant or bar license, or they could run just a bar license and not the liquor store or restaurant or any of those combinations. But in no instance can private industry run any license. And so this new local option that House Bill 155 would create allows the municipality the option to operate a liquor license, the option for private industry to run a restaurant license, and the option to let private industry run a bar license, and any combination of those three. In the end, if House Bill 155 passes, it just gives municipalities a new option. They can exercise it or not exercise it. It won't change existing local options. It just adds to it. And it won't change local option election law. And I'm available for questions.
Okay. Representative Holland? Great. And before you go, I wanted to point out in your packet, we've also got the list of which communities. So in case you didn't, I wanted to draw your attention to that. We got that from somebody at AMCO. So go ahead, Representative Holland.
Thank you, through the chair. And first off, thank you for this presentation. This is, for me, very helpful to have some of the history and the structure of this. I've heard some of the vernacular and terms of this, but you've laid it out very nicely, and this is very helpful for me. I am curious, and perhaps I'm sure I'm missing a detail. It appears that what this new local option does of providing flexibility, in essence, it would appear to me to essentially be option two, which, as I understand option two, the community can pick which license types they'll allow. And so I'm wondering if you could clarify for me what apparently option two doesn't allow that this new option is allowing, or just the fine detail, because it appears that this new option under House Bill 155 essentially allows anybody to do most anything, which I think is option two. So
none of the options right now allow private. Is that maybe I'm misunderstanding, Mr. LeVol?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So option two is exclusively private.
Okay.
But they're choosing different license types. The difference is that option three is exclusive management of the license by municipalities. So it's about who operates the license, not about what license is allowed.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
So just to clarify then, under option two, is a municipality not allowed to have a license?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. It's not that, it's that option two does not ban anybody except municipalities from operating a license. So in option two, you would not restrict private industry from operating any license type. Option three means only a municipality can operate a license.
Thank
I would
you.
Say
Thank
and
you.
Add that I thought that the drafting of the bill would have been different, and much like option four, I think would have been better done by amending option, or option five would have been better done as an amendment to option four. Drafting is what drafting is, and I am increasingly of the opinion that when the Title IV rewrite had been done, that it would have been good for the local options to have been addressed, but they were not.
Thank you for now, Chair. I made progress. I lost progress, and
yeah.
I'm going to consider it.
I thought I had it.
I'm going to consider it a win for the moment. That I'm back to where I was. Not quite sure, but this is really valuable information.
Your win
Thank
is
you.
My loss because I thought I had it. Now I'm completely lost again. Rep. Prox, did you have a question?
No, that kind of sorted it out. And didn't the my understanding? Well, yeah, okay. Also, my understanding of the bill is that it just simply, in a community that currently under the law has municipal governments can run a liquor license, and if the municipality wanted to operate a liquor license in a restaurant, they could do that. But under the current law, if a municipality elects whatever option it is, the municipality could still run the package license, but the change would enable a private individual to, or private company to run a liquor license in a restaurant.
Mr. Lebel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is absolutely correct.
And am I correct? I was in Kotzebue, and there's trouble with, well, any law, but I think in Kotzebue, evidently the municipality runs package stores, and there are a couple of restaurants that, much to my surprise, didn't serve alcohol. And is that kind of the issue? There's a big hotel up there that does not, they serve very nice meals, they do not serve alcohol. And I think they're run by, it's a native corporation, I don't know, it doesn't matter, it's private, it's not the municipality. But is that the problem we're kind of trying to solve?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is part of what we're trying to solve. There's an interest kind of on the other end of the spectrum as well. This idea was brought to us from a constituent out of Nome. Nome is currently exercises no local option, but there is interest in the municipality operating a package store, but they don't want to affect the restaurants or bars.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mr. Lebel, I need to understand that. So you say Nome is not using any local option, meaning anybody can do anything. You can run a package store if you want to. You can run a bar. You can run a restaurant with alcohol. And so you're saying this would allow Nome, the municipality, to offer a package store.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is correct.
So here's something I'm struggling with this bill. If you're a municipality and you've exercised a local option for the municipality to operate a package store, why do communities make that decision? I assume it's a revenue generator. Isn't that the reason your municipality would choose to run a package store?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. There's multiple reasons you might want to go down that road. Revenue is certainly one, and it's one of the things contemplated by the person who brought that to us, is you could use revenue from the package store to run treatment programs or warming shelters, things like that.
So under HB 155, now if a private, I'm just wondering if it will undercut the municipal package store to have, and I guess that's the free market, right? So we're allowing communities to open their market, basically.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that's kind of exactly the idea, is to expand the number of options that are available for the people to vote on.
Okay, great. Are there other questions in the committee? Okay. I'm still grappling with this one, but great. I think what we'll do is go ahead and, without additional questions, we'll set this bill aside and set an amendment deadline for Tuesday, March 10th at 1 p.m. So Tuesday, March 10th at 1 p.m. And and then we'll just set the bill aside for today. Representative Prox?
If I could ask the privilege of, if someone wants to, one of the committee members wants to amend the bill, if you would extend me the courtesy of a conversation. I have run into a couple of, one personally, of this local option. We were, my dad was flying one plane, I was flying another, and we wanted to land at a village airport to transfer gas from my plane to his. And we landed, pulled up to the parking spot, and two guys with shotguns came out to greet us. That's what we thought. and it turned out it was really pretty good for local enforcement. It was a dry village, turned out. We didn't even think about it. And they had authorized some fellow to go get a charter to go in for a medical problem. And then they found out that, no, what he was doing was to go into Fairbanks to go on a drunk. And when that guy was coming back, they were coming out to meet him. The two guys with shotguns thought we were him. And we had a good conversation, but it was a little tense. Mm-hmm. And then another thing that happened, a friend of mine that's still going through the courts, I believe, a friend of mine had his airplane confiscated because a passenger had brought liquor on board. Frankly, I thought it was a setup. But if you don't know, had we had alcohol, if you don't know, you are exposed to very serious consequences. So it's a difficult situation. But basically, it is what it is. The villages have got their problems. I'm willing to put up with it. But if we're going to amend something, if you would, please give me a call.
Okay, and I see Rep. Holland has a question. And then thanks to Thatcher, I completely skipped over public testimony, so we need to do that as well. And Representative Holland, do you have another question?
Well, thank you, Chair. I was going to ask what public testimony we've heard on this any invited testimony, because I guess given my lack of familiarity and kind of the fog of these different options, it would, to me, be very helpful to have some clarity and voice from some of the communities that are operating these current municipal package stores and are considering these options, just to understand their perspective on some of these questions we've had about, does this undermine things? So perhaps the public testimony addresses that. Perhaps there's a little bit more that maybe we could hear from before we're making final decisions, because this is
there's kind of a list in your packet of the communities. You're welcome to reach out.
Yeah, I've got that list. I was just asking about testimony that we might be hearing. Thank you.
Mr. LeBol, I think we'll move on to public testimony I don't see any invited testimony. So, okay. We're going to go ahead and open public testimony. And I don't see anyone online, and I don't see anyone in the room. So we will close public testimony. And then I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay, so we're back on the record, and we are going to go ahead and set that amendment deadline for Tuesday, March 10th at 1. And I know committee members have said that more information is needed, so I'll leave that with you, Mr. LeBol, and Rep. Prox. I know if there are folks are planning amendments, I think you would like them to also chat with you?
I would really appreciate it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. So that bill is set aside. Amendment deadline Tuesday, March 10th at 1 p.m. And we're going to move on now to the final item on our agenda, House Bill 220, an act relating to easements and rights of way in state parks. This is the first hearing on the bill. I'd like to invite Representative McCabe. I hope I'm saying it right, Elisheva Almeida, to the table to introduce the bill. Welcome. Good morning. Glad you're here.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing us to introduce this bill and members of the committee. I promise it won't be near as entertaining as the last one. So for the record, my name is Representative Kevin McCabe. I represent House District 30, and today I'm presenting House Bill 220 relating to easements and rights of way in state parks. As we all know, Alaska is unique. Across our state, private property, utility corridors, and state park lands are often interwoven, intertwined. Families, businesses, and utility providers rely on lawful easements to access property and to maintain critical infrastructure. But when those easements are delayed, subjected to inconsistent standards, or replaced with lesser permits, it creates uncertainty, increases costs, and can stall or even prevent important projects from moving forward. HB 220 provides clarity, predictability, and accountability. The bill requires the DNR to grant an easement when statutory criteria are met and sets a firm day decision deadline. If DNR fails to act, the easement is approved, ensuring timely decisions and certainty for applicants. More importantly, HB 220 brings DNR into alignment with Administrative Order 360, reinforcing streamlined permitting and eliminating unnecessary regulatory hurdles. It puts those directives into statute for state park easements. Madam Chair, the bill modernizes the process by allowing GPS-based surveys and requiring environmental review to match a project's scope and impacts. It eliminates duplicative and unrelated requirements while preserving DNR's authority to protect park resources and public safety. HB 220 also clarifies that the public interest includes access to private property, reliable utility service, infrastructure improvements, and benefits to local communities and Alaska's economy. This is a balanced, common-sense measure. It strengthens due process. It improves government accountability, supports responsible infrastructure development, and preserves stewardship of Alaska's state parks while ensuring state agencies operate consistently with the governor's directive to streamline and modernize permitting. At this time, Chair Himshute, with your permission, I'd like to invite my staff member, Elisheva Almeida, to walk the committee through the sectional analysis, if you would like.
That sounds great. Ms. Almeida?
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elisheva Almeida, staff to Representative McCabe. The sectional for House Bill 220 is as follows. Section 1 amends AS 41-21-024A to require a DNR to grant a park easement when statutory criteria are met. Section 2 adds new subsections B through I, establishing standards and timelines. It requires easements to provide adequate access for the full life cycle of infrastructure, requires issuance when criteria are met, and prohibits substituting lesser authorizations, clarifies application requirements and allows GPS-based surveys, requires proportional environmental review, establishes a 60-day decision deadline, requires written reasons for denial, and provides for automatic approval if no action is taken, prohibits unrelated, duplicative, vague, or unequal conditions, protects valid existing easements, clarifies the public interest, includes property access, utility infrastructure, and community and economic benefit. Section 3 updates applicable language and applies the changes prospectively. Thank you for your attention. That concludes the sectional.
Okay, thank you. McCabe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a little background. This was brought to me by a constituent who lives across the shore on Nancy Lake in the state park, or the state park. He's on the edge of it, but the power line to his property and others' property over there runs under the lake. It was apparently permitted under a previous lake management plan that is no longer applicable. So the problem is it's 40 years old. it gets pinholes in it, and when it gets pinholes and leaks, it shuts power off to those houses on the other side of the lake. To fix it is a five-hour event. They have to go out there. They have to pull it up out of the water, repair it, fix it somehow, put it back into the water. It takes a long time. MEA would like to replace it. That's the fix. When my constituent contacted MEA, they said, we got to talk to DNR. When he contacted DNR, he received the following email. This was July 1st of 2024. With regards to MEA's from Stuart R. Leitner, who is the superintendent up in that region of the park, with regards to MEA, I have attached the director's determination, which is dated in 2022, and I can get a copy of that to everybody if you'd like, redacted to take out the applicant. It spells out why we can't authorize it. The next sentence is really what this bill's about. The next sentence says, the remedy is for a legislative fix. HB 220 is that legislative fix. Mr. Leitner continues, I have to follow the existing guidelines and rules. It would also require an entire amendment, including public comment for the current management plan, which would also take time to get through the process. I can tell you that it could take a few years just to redo the lake management plan. So here's the remedy. This is the legislative fix. And with that, I have all sorts of other data, and I'm ready for questions. So.
You also have all sorts of invited testimony.
I do have all sorts of invited
testimony. Are there any questions from the committee quickly before we go to invited testimony? All right, let's hear from some folks on this bill. So we're going to start with Julie Esty, Chief Strategy Officer of Matanuska Electric Association. Could you please unmute yourself, put your name on the record, and share your thoughts with us?
Hello, greetings, co-chairs Hemshoot and Mears. This is Julie Esky. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer for Matanuska Electric Association. And I'm joined by MEA land manager Manny Lopez, who has about 30, maybe even pushing 40 years of experience in the business if you all have specific detailed questions. We are testifying in support of House Bill 220. And while we respect state parks jurisdiction to protect critical state resources that in which they've been entrusted, the inconsistency and applying the regulations and protracted timelines have caused unnecessary delays in decisions, resulting in costs and loss of investments for members and escalating costs, impacting reliability and possibly creating future safety issues for MEA as projects get delayed over months and years. We believe this bill strikes an effective balance between state parks jurisdiction and the issues that our utility is dealing with. And I think bill sponsor, Representative McCabe, gave a great solid example from our Nancy Lake Holdings. From the utility side, we have been trying over years to replace failing facilities or install new ones. For instance, we have a line that needs to be relocated due to erosion issues, but we cannot receive the authorization to get that done. So this is currently a reliability issue that as the lake continues to erode some of our facilities, it could also become a safety issue in the future. This has been an issue for members as well. We have electrical infrastructure throughout Nancy Lake State Park serving adjacent properties and inholdings. Members will buy properties and subdivisions with adjacent electrical facilities, assuming if neighbors have power, they will as well, only to have either delays or denials of easement provisions as they're inconsistently applied. This is, again, not only been an issue for members in adding new facility, but also, as I mentioned before, issues with MEA upgrading or replacing existing infrastructure, even things like upgrading the size of line to meet the growing loads adjacent to the state park, or fixing significant issues like erosions or replacements of aging infrastructure. Some of our facilities there have been in place for now upwards of 60 years, and the needs to upgrade are significant. This impacts our duty to serve and poses a safety risk if our equipment is not allowed to be properly sized or replaced after it performs past its useful life. MEA works with several state agencies for permits, including the Umbrella Agency over State Parks, DNR. We also work with the DOT, DEC, the Railroad, and other state agencies, and do not experience these delays and inconsistency issues. In the past, we actually have had similar issues with DNR, but we worked with the agency to come up with a path forward and have been really successful in working with that agency around easements, balancing, again, the needs, growing needs of the electrical needs in those areas, as well balancing with their critical jurisdiction to protect their lands. Similar efforts have been attempted with state parks with no resolution, and we agree with the bill sponsor and with state parks in addition that this requires a legislative fix. That concludes my testimony. I'm available for questions. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Esty. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Esty? Okay, seeing no questions, we'll move on to Rob Montgomery, Chief Operating Officer from the Homer Electric Association. Please put your name on the record and tell us your thoughts.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Rob Montgomery, Chief Operating Officer for Homer Electric. I'm joined by our Land Management Officer, Scott Huff. Through the chair, we appreciate the opportunity this morning to testify, and our comments will be brief. I thought NEA did a really good job of outlining the benefits of the legislation, as well as some of the challenges we faced in the past. We do have properties as well, certainly across the bay here, outside of Homer, where we've had challenges in the past. This bill, we think, will greatly improve the process, and so we, too, are supportive of the proposed bill. To give you some specifics from HEA's perspective, I'm going to turn it over to Scott for a few comments.
Yes, thank you. This is Scott Huff. HEA has reviewed this proposal, and we are in agreement with it. Right now, HEA has a distribution line that runs within Kachemak Bay State Park, and it runs from Talbot Cove in the north, down to Tutka Bay in the south, and it continues onward to Seldovia, Port Graham, and Don Wallach. Currently, we have 34 meters that are located within the Kachemak Bay State Park boundary. So with these private inholdings and future subdivisions and new developments, there will be a need for HEA to supply electricity to consumers in the future, and easements will be a great way to define those locations and allow us to install and maintain and even upgrade those lines in the future. A couple items we really like in this legislation is that it requires an easement as opposed to a permit. That easement will be recorded in the public records and be provided in the future so you can always locate it. The easement will also be specific on the location and use, and then a survey will be attached so in the future you can always locate that easement, have a licensed land surveyor stake it out in the ground. The 60-day approval period is also a good benefit. As our construction season is pretty short, that provides a good timeline for both the consumer and the utility providers, so we know what kind of timeline we're looking at. So in conclusion, HEA is supportive of this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Montgomery or Mr. Huff? Okay. Seeing no questions, we'll move on to Jason Custer, who's here in the room, VP of Corporate Development of Alaska Power and Telephone Company. Welcome, Mr. Custer. Please put your name on record and share your thoughts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jason Custer, and I work as Vice President of Alaska Power and Telephone Company. We're an employee-owned company serving 40 rural communities spanning 1,200 miles, the distance from Washington, D.C. to Cuba. We were founded in Skagway in 1957, and today we're proudly headquartered in Ketchikan. We only have 160 employees serving those 40 communities, and we're builders. We've built hydro and transmission projects across the state, which have made us 75% renewable today, and our focus lately has been building fiber optic networks, both terrestrial and submarine fiber optic networks. And in the last 5 years, we've made and brought in more than $100 million of investment in fiber projects. We're testifying in support of House Bill 220, The bill provides clear and responsible guidance and establishes a common set of expectations that utilities and state personnel can use to plan for orderly and responsible project development of infrastructure needed by rural Alaskans. Improved permitting certainty is particularly important considering the $629 million in telecom projects that the Alaska Broadband Grant Program is preparing to award across the state in just a couple weeks. Project permitting activities will begin in the coming months all across Alaska. While AP&T is not currently seeking to develop infrastructure in state park land, we're aware of various low-impact hydropower and transmission opportunities near our service areas that could become helpful to Alaskans in the future that may rely upon crossing state park land. We serve numerous islanded locations that rely on submarine cables, both for electrical transmission and fiber optic telecom services, and access to land to build infrastructure is very difficult because of the federal land management restrictions, particularly in Southeast, 90% of which is the Tongass National Forest and subject to the roadless rule. As an example of a project that this could have helped, 10 years ago, we were working to develop a submarine fiber optic cable between Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. In the course of permitting the project, we found that the cable would go through a state marine park. And there's actually something on the map in the marine park that said cable area. While the project was low impact and non-controversial from an environmental standpoint, you know, a submarine fiber optic cable is about the diameter of a reindeer sausage, just laying on the ocean floor, so very low impact. Nobody really had any issues with it, but the state's permitting process was not clear. And working through the issue of how to get through the state marine park added a year to the project's timeline. Well, we had purchased the cable, and it arrived in Seattle, and because of the delay, we had to figure out how to store 89 miles of cable in Seattle. And a submarine cable, you can't just cut it into pieces and store it in containers somewhere. You have to store it as a giant 89-mile thing. And so that ended up adding more than $600,000 to the cost of the project as we tried to figure this out with State DNR, who wanted to allow it but just had a difficult time finding a pathway forward. Eventually, we got through it. It's in everybody's interest to keep the cost of rural utility services as affordable as possible. Ultimately, when permitting delays projects, adds to their cost, or makes development impossible, it's the communities that suffer in terms of higher costs, delayed services, or reduced access to renewables. So in conclusion, Alaska Power and Telephone encourages the state legislature to take action to pass this bill. It's in the best interest of all stakeholders. And I really wish you could also help fix our problems with the National Park Service, but I realize that's beyond your ambit. Thank you, and glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Custer. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay.
Sorry.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, you mentioned hydropower. And I guess that raises some flags, not knowing anything about your situation. But over time, there in the nation, there are some hydropower projects that seemed like a great idea in the 20s and 30s, I think. And now I think there are even some of them being taken out. So there was arguably in inadequate permitting process in the 20s and 30s, and I suppose even the 1800s. is that this would reduce DNR's authority to interfere with hydro projects?
Through the chair. The reason I mentioned hydropower is because, you know, we're a very small utility with small service areas, and we're aware of some small hydro projects outlying our service areas that, you know, to get to them, you'd have to cross state parkland with transmission. And we don't need them now, but they're there for the future. If there would ever be a good reason to develop them. Yeah, I would love to go back to how they used to do hydro permitting in the 1800s, but it was done. You know, we need to have a responsible pathway to develop any kind of project. There needs to be criteria laid out in advance. Mm-hmm. As a developer, you need to understand what the permitting timeline is, the types of studies and questions you'll have to answer, and you want to get that all figured out in advance and not encounter it in the middle of a project like we did when we were trying to do this cable project from Juneau up to Haines and Skagway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that'll be...
Yeah, thanks. So through the chair, Representative Prox, nothing in this bill weakens environmental standards. The statutory criteria are unchanged. The commissioner must still determine the easement will not unduly affect the park. Remember, this is just for parks.
Right.
Resources. It must still comply with all the other applicable laws, all the other environmental standards that are that a normal permitting would do. All this does is changes the timeline a bit. And puts a little pressure on the DNR to get the permit out. So no environmental change whatsoever.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee for Mr. Custer? Okay. Seeing no questions from the committee, we'll move on. I see Christine O'Connor is also in the room. So if you could come forward. Christine is the executive director of the Alaska Telecom Association and a former school librarian. I think that's valuable to know.
And Ms.
O'Connor, we do love our librarians. If you could put your name on record and share with us.
Good morning. Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute, Co-Chair Mears. For the record, my name is Christine O'Connor. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Telecom Association and a proud former librarian. But this morning, I'm here representing Alaska Telecom Association, and we represent Alaska's telecommunications and broadband providers, serving Alaskans throughout the state. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning in support of House Bill 220. This bill would improve permitting process for easements within state parks and help ensure that our critical broadband infrastructure can be deployed efficiently. House Bill 220 is particularly timely for our industry. Just last week, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration approved Alaska's plan to spend the Broadband Equity and Deployment Funds, the broadband funds from IJA, the infrastructure bill. $620 million are coming to Alaska to build projects that will serve over 46,000 locations. This is a tremendous investment and a huge win for Alaska, and it comes after literally years of dedicated work by Department of Commerce, Alaska Broadband Office, and the administration to make sure the program worked right for Alaska. So we're delighted. But now the work really begins. There's a very short construction window for this program, 4 years. Potential one-year extension at the approval of the Department of Commerce. So that's a challenging. The success of this program will depend heavily on whether permitting can be done efficiently. So these projects can move forward without unnecessary delay. It's not uncommon for permits to be delayed a year or 2 years, and that will just make some of these projects fall outside that window, which is not allowed under IJA. So HB 220 strikes a sensible balance. As Representative McCabe said, it protects all the environmental regulations are still in place. It just balances that so that projects can move forward in a predictable and timely way. This bill will help ensure that Alaskans can fully realize the benefits of our historic broadband investment by providing clarity, predictability, and timely decisions when infrastructure must cross state parklands. I'll also note that permitting streamlining was one of the big recommendations coming out of the Task Force on Broadband that was running about the same time as IJA. So for these reasons, ATA strongly supports House Bill 220. We would like to thank Representative McCabe for bringing this bill forward, and also thank the committee for hearing the bill and for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you. Are there committee questions for Ms. O'Connor? Okay. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll move to our final invited testifier, who's calling in from an earlier time zone and has been on the line for a while. So thank you for being here, Mike Klowitter from the Nancy Lake Association. Please unmute yourself, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Very good. Good morning, and thanks from Hawaii. My name is Mike Klowitter. I'm the president of the Nancy Lake Association which is up in Nancy Lake in the Willow area, just north of Houston. And we have about 300 residents that live around Nancy Lake, and approximately 40 Matanuska Electric Association members who receive their power underwater on the lake. And the power system was put in approximately 50 years ago, and the shelf life, useful life of that power system in the water is 50 years, which we're now have crossed over that line, so its service life has come to an end. And DNR, I've talked with the regional director, Stuart Liedner, superintendent, and I asked him a couple questions, one of which is if there's any damage or any data or environmental studies that show any harmful effects of underwater power being delivered to families across the lake. And he indicated that no, there was no environmental issues with the power in the water that he was aware of. And, you know, as that system ages, and you have to understand what it takes to repair an underwater power line when there's currently 40 inches plus of ice over the lake right now. And during freeze-up and breakup times, it becomes very challenging, if doable at all, to try and repair a 50-year-old line, which is at its service life end. So I was one of the ones that sort of raised the flag with Representative McCain's office. And, you know, with 40 families on the line that have questionable power at this point, we've seen an increase in outages just due to the age of the line. I thought it was important to bring that to his attention and try and come up with a fix, since the entire lake and a good bit of the land area around Nancy Lake is under the state parks regulations. So I did want to speak in support of HB 220, and would thank you for your support in moving this forward, and be happy to answer any questions you might have at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Clowder. Got it.
Clowder, yeah, it's okay. One of those names easier said with marbles in your mouth.
Well, just be thankful it's not him shooting. are there questions? Representative Prox and then Representative Holland.
Yes, through the chair. I'm supportive of the bill at this point, but I do want to kind of be the devil's advocate. In this particular case at Nancy Lake, it's the line reaching the end of its life. And could the cable just be replaced with the current permit? Or do you need the permit to even replace the cable?
So through the chair, I think I can answer that, Representative Prox. So through the chair, that's what they're trying to do, is replace the cable, and the parks director in the parks is saying that no, they cannot, because there is a new lake management plan that says no underwater cables. And that's they made that determination for a single guy that wanted to put it under the lake to his house. And this was in 2022, I believe. And then 2 years later, they leaned on that decision when MEA requested it and when Mr. Clowder requested it with Stuart Liedner. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Holland.
Thank you. I'm going to go down the same kind of devil's advocate pathway with Mr. Clowder. I have property to the north of you up on Trapper Lake, and we're looking at some major projects coming through the area. And to the degree that this legislation would allow a power line to be put under the water, it's pretty benign. Once it's done, we'll never see it. Same could be said of perhaps a fiber optic project. Come in, do it. In most cases, you never see that there's even a line afterwards, other than maybe occasionally a little flag marker or something that says that in there. But I'm curious, sir, if this legislation goes in, as I understand it, this could also allow a road to be put through the park to potentially somebody's new lodge. It could be a pipeline, could be given a permit to go through the state park right behind the neighbors in there. And I'm just wondering, from the standpoint of a homeowners association looking at the recreational opportunities in the state park,
how you view this in terms of your ability and the owners in that area to be able to have input on what could be a much different project if it was a major regional transmission line, a pipeline, a road that somebody wanted to put in that was going across the park to a new facility. Would you want this same streamlined fast track 60-day process, or would you as homeowners want to see a process that might provide you a little more protection?
Okay, the question was directed to Mr. Klobuchar. I see that Rep. Mm-hmm. McCabe would like to respond. Can we start with Representative McCabe, and then, or would you prefer to go to Mr. Klobuchar?
Your call. I'm kind of interested
in. We will hear from both. So Representative McCabe, and then we'll go to Mr. Klobuchar.
Thanks. Yeah, and so through the chair, Representative Holland, if you read on line 7 and 8 on page 1, it's specifically for the upgrade, removal, or replacement of public utility facilities and infrastructure. It was never intended to allow the creation or the installation of a new road. I suppose to the extent that they had to put in a road to get to something, probably, but it's not intended to create a new pathway or a new road to somebody else's, to somebody's house.
Mr. Klobuchar, could you add?
Yeah, I believe that that's true. You know, I've actually tried to get road easements through state ground before in the park area as a way to getting to the west side of Nancy Lake, and ended up working with the borough instead. But very challenging to try and get an easement through parks for non-utility related things. They're very protective of the park and access to it, can own a good bit of the land around Nancy Lake, and have public use cabins as well, which they have trail access to, snow machine access, and then water access as well. And there's actually no trail, well, one trail, but no roads or anything that connect those state use cabins. So it's all remote access, essentially. And I was going to add one other point that I'd forgotten was the NEA power line in Nancy Lake is 50 years old, and that was in the water prior to the park even being created. So that kind of adds another dimension to it, and that underwater power on the lake was put in before the park's existence, just as a point of interest as well.
Thank you, Mr. Klobuchar. Any other questions for Mr. Klobuchar? Okay, I have a few questions.
Sure.
Or does the committee have questions?
I do have some questions.
Mr. Nelson, or Representative Nelson, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. What is to, I'll just ask the question, and maybe I misunderstand how this will be applied, but, you know, it sounds like it makes total sense for a lot of these relatively smaller projects, especially with pre-existing infrastructure. Makes a lot of sense. What if there was a larger project that fell within this that might need more than 60 days? If that's, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking out there, would this basically still give them that hard stop of 60 days on a larger project?
Through the chair, Representative Nelson, so the 60 days is, it's specifically for the smaller projects. A larger project is obviously going to cross more than the state park. It's probably going to need federal NEPA stuff, which we don't have to do if we're just in a state park and on state land. Might need an environmental impact statement. This is specifically directed at a small portion of what they're doing. You can think of this as sort of our mini Fast 41 in the state, you know, where we're trying to streamline the permitting process for these small, you know, projects specific to the state park. I mean, that's kind of important if you.
That actually does help. That clarifies it. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Holland.
Or if we're going to move on from the current testifier, or are we?
Yeah. Yep. We're. Unless anybody has a question, I think we're clarified we don't have any more questions for Mr. Klobuchar, but thank you for calling in if you're still online. But Representative Holland, questions on the bill?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I had a couple things I just wanted to follow up on. One is it's not clear to me, and perhaps you could point out through the chair, what this language requires in terms of local notice and local participation in this decision-making.
Representative McCabe.
Through the chair, Representative Holland, it requires the same local notice and local participation that's in any permitting process. All this does is shrink the timeline. This just basically says state parks, it should not take you a month or 2 months or 6 months or a year to do this. You should be able to do this. So MEA is going to go through all that will happen. MEA puts out a notice. They say we're going to put this cable in here. There'll be a public permitting, public discussion process. Then they apply for the permit. Say we did this. Here's the public process. Here's the input. And then once that's all done, then the permit is into this 60-day window.
Follow up. Thank you for that. Legislature last session had a set of companion bills for Chugach State Park to allow a right-of-way and the ability of DNR to allow the local road service district to cut through. That was House Bill 128 and Senate Bill 47. I'm curious if this bill anticipates and would have addressed that issue and made the need for that special legislation for park access unnecessary.
Representative McCabe.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Holland, I really don't know. I mean, that dealt with roads, and this kind of deals with a sausage-sized, power line that goes under the lake or under Kachemak Bay. So I'm not real certain. I do remember hearing those bills. I don't remember if this would be applicable at all to those.
Okay, thank you. And last question.
Final follow-up?
Yeah. There's a couple pieces of legislation that have been introduced related to right-of-ways and wildfire mitigation planning, and I'm curious if you've looked at how this might overlap with that legislation. That's both House Bill 252 and House Bill 317.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Through the chair, Representative Holland, I have no idea. Sorry, I haven't even tried to juxtapose the two or the three of them.
Okay, very good. I'll follow up with that later. Thank you.
Okay. Great. I have a couple of questions as well, because we would not ever want to finish this committee early. So, do you want to go next? Go ahead. Okay. Representative McCabe, how many state parks are there, or more importantly, how many state parks are in an area where you would need utility easements? I mean, there are some state parks that are unlikely to ever be in an inhabited area, but there are state parks that have this issue. So can you speak to that?
Chair Hemshute, sorry, but I did not do any research on the number of state parks. Maybe, and I'm going to put her on the spot, but maybe Julie Esty would know at least where MEA is, and maybe the Homer Electric.
Yeah, I'm looking more for the broader picture, so I think we'll hold that question.
Okay.
And then, since state parks is housed within DNR, I'm trying to understand the difference between what your legislation would do and the standard DNR process. So, and a major concern I have is state park staffing. So you've got an aggressive timeline that no one else is held to in a division that is famously underfunded. We can't get upkeep on a lot of park assets, and I can tell you stories about our state parks in Sitka where we can't go in and do anything because it's a state park, but the state parks don't have the capacity to do it either. So what is the difference between the DNR timeline and the state park timeline, and why would that be different?
Chair Hemshute, so that's a very good question. I'm not sure that there is much difference other than the DNR can obviously take more time. The state parks has been famously reluctant to grant permits. We do have based on the fiscal note, we do have some requests in to the DNR to tell us how many permits they actually receive. a year, maybe, or over the last 5 years, how many permits they have actually received or adjudicated or denied, and how long it takes for each permit. That's forthcoming.
And then I guess I'm confused also. So since state parks reside under DNR, why is there a separate process? There must be a higher standard because it's protected land, right? It's not just state land. It's protected state land. And so that sets a different standard?
Chair Himshut, you have the same exact question I have. Why is there a different standard, and why is it seem like the state park is such an issue when it is under DNR? Should be seamless, what one would think. Mm-hmm. But it seems to be another level that the electric utilities need to go through. And frankly, with all of the coming broadband money and work, this is sorely needed legislation so we can get her done.
And I think we're going to need to quantify, you know, is this three parks somewhere in the state or is it 80 parks? So we're going to need to get that number. And then how do you define public utilities and infrastructure? I don't see a definition in the bill.
Oh, that's another good question, Chair Hume. So
that's why we have committees.
Sure. Yeah, I get that. So the Ledge Legal didn't really define that. So we can certainly put a definition in this via an amendment. But I think public utilities, I wonder if it's defined elsewhere in code.
We should probably narrow that down and be really clear, because again, I'm trying to understand where you've got a division in a department and we're setting a different standard and they're holding a different standard already. And so if we're going to allow a sausage sized cable, but not a pipeline, I need to understand that. So, okay. I think Co-Chair Mears has questions as well.
Thank you through the chair. And you started going down the lane where I was headed, and I do want to acknowledge that we just have a few minutes left here today, and we'll need some, I think, further discussion on some things as we get into it. But through the chair to Representative McCabe, how much did you work with DNR, either as a whole or with state parks, on developing the bill?
Representative McCabe.
Co-Chair Mears, through the chair, we did work with DNR. Unfortunately, Joe Burns, who I was working with, is no longer here. He's moved on. So we sort of had to restart this summer. We ran the bill through them twice, I believe, and they came back with some changes, and we accepted some and we didn't accept others. But they have seen the bill, so I don't know if that's the normal amount of time. I'm just kind of doing what needed to be done as far as getting everybody on board. So the MEA has also seen the bill. The utilities have seen the bill and worked with us and made some suggestions for changes, which we put back through DNR. So I think probably three or four conversations last year, though, mostly.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yeah. Yes. Thank you, through the chair. On a follow-up to that, I wanted to dive into the change in surveying practice. What were the conversations around that?
Through the chair, vice chair or co-chair Mears, the conversations around the GPS surveying were not specifically with DNR, other than the fact that it takes so long to survey in the winter. It was an idea that we had with the discussion with Ledge Legal, and truthfully, I don't remember what Joe told me specifically about GPS surveying. It's, you know, we're all going to GPS surveying, frankly, from Loran of years ago. So,
follow-up comment? Follow-up? Thank you, through the chair. So, I, of course, as a civil engineer, very familiar with surveying and all that, and need to catch up on what evolving practices there are with that standard, if we're moving completely there. What other where are we with the technical language and where we need to be with that, because as we've seen in not such a short period of time, our technologies keep changing and improving. So making sure that if there is a shift into more of this remote surveying, how we capture that. And if there are changes in practice for surveying requirements in other places in the state. So I think that's all I've got on the tip of my tongue for this morning. But I think as we get into this, there's a number of issues that we need to parse out.
It's the first hearing. So.
Sure.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? If not, I do have the signed affidavit that we will have donuts at a future committee hearing, signed by my staff and dated today. We can get it notarized. And that concludes our business for today. Please remember the amendment deadlines. Let's see, I think it's House Bill 155 at 1 p.m. Tuesday, March 10th. And then we will announce next week's schedule later today. Seeing no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned at 9:54 a.m.